All right. Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Mickey McManus, who will be speaking with us this hour. So Mickey is Senior Advisor at BCG. So this interview is an element of IRI's digitalization community. The DXC is a resource for IRI members as you build your digital capabilities. Through the DXC, you can access case studies with white papers with fresh relevant content. Case studies and white papers. We also have a conference dedicated to digital transformation. That's Digital Futures, and it's happening in Cleveland in person. Yay. October 11th through the 13th at Case Western Reserve University. We have roundtable discussions on key topics. We've got one coming up tomorrow. We're going to talk about digital tools and employee well-being. We do updates and insights with additional resources, and then webinar interviews with thought leaders like we're doing today. And these always take place on the third Thursday of the month at noon Eastern. And I'll be sure to sign all of you up for updates if you don't already receive them. And if you don't want to receive them, just let me know. Just a few housekeeping items to get through before we can begin our conversation with Mickey. So first, this session is being recorded and you will get a link to the recording. We'll be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there'll not be any visuals here today. Second, please hold all questions until the end. Once we open the floor to questions, you can type your question in and I'll read it out for you, or you can unmute yourself and turn your camera on and join us for a conversation. All right, let's get started. Mickey, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So can you tell us a bit about your background?
I was trained as an industrial designer. I went to University of Illinois in Chicago. And my focus originally was product design and designing products, you know, for mass manufacturing. And then I ended up stumbling into the world of exhibition design and experience design and designing large scale experiences, and learned how to create drama and theater from that space, but also how do you build large architectural spaces, and ended up working on the second largest structure down in the Sydney Olympics, in the Olympics of 2000. The Athlete and Family Pavilion. And we built the whole thing and had about 1 million people go through it in 15 days. It was pretty crazy. So that was exciting. And then I ended up joining a place called Maya that came out of Carnegie Mellon in 1989. And Maya stood for most advanced yet acceptable. And it was a terminology that was coined by Raymond Loewy back in the 1930s. He said, if you could find the most advanced technology that was appropriate, but make it acceptable for normal people, you had found this kind of sweet spot called the Maya zone. And that's what we focused on. And we had an interdisciplinary crew of people from cognitive psychologists, anthropologists, ethnographers to study people, to electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, computer scientists, mathematicians to look at how you make things work, and to designers. So interaction designers, architects, game designers, product designers. So it was a really interesting, who understood sort of form and function and how do you create magical experiences. And I was the CEO and one of the owners of that for 14 years. And then we ended up selling it to Boston Consulting Group, BCG. And now it is this sort of human-centered focus and research focus has been rolling out throughout the different offices at BCG.
Oh, that's awesome. So your work at Maya was focused on interdisciplinary creation. So what are some lessons learned that may be helpful for those in R&D and innovation?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that every single Mayan, when they started at Maya, they actually had to read certain books. And so if you were a cognitive psychologist, you had to read The Mythical Man Month so you could understand how engineers thought. And that was just one of them. But if you were a designer, you actually had to read Herb Simon's book about sciences of complexity and sciences of the artificial to really understand how cognitive psychologists and how economists think. So people in the soft sciences. And if you were an engineer, you'd actually have to read Raymond Loewy's Never Leave Well Enough Alone. And the reason we insisted on that was that we really needed people to understand that there was a there. Like if you're in a particular discipline, you're an engineer, you read the engineering magazines, you were graded on engineering, you're surrounded by engineers. And so you think truth is over there. And if you're a cognitive psychologist or an anthropologist or something like that, you know, you read a totally different set of magazines. You're measured by a different, you know, different journal. You're measured by a different thing. And you think truth is over there. And so you're a little skeptical that the other discipline has anything that they could, that's even real, that it could teach you anything. And so one of the things we invested in was this notion that you had to actually trust that other disciplines had something to bring to the table and maybe actually were farther along in their journey on certain dimensions than your discipline was. And so that was one part of it. The other part was that interdisciplinary collaboration is really hard. Anytime someone says that they do interdisciplinary collaboration, I'm like, okay, tell me a little bit about that. And if I hear that they like fight standing at a whiteboard, like really, you know, sort of really exploring ideas and playing with things, I think, okay, that makes sense. But if they say, oh yeah, we have these meetings and we invite marketers and engineers and others, and you know, we're doing it, I don't think you're doing interdisciplinary collaboration. It's hard. And you have to invest in it. And one of the things we found that worked the best was I set a whiteboard. It turns out that drawing is the lingua franca between disciplines. If you draw a blob for a noun and an arrow for a verb, everybody can understand it. And you can go, well, just draw what you mean. And so one of the things you'd hear walking the corridors was, well, just draw it. Draw what you're talking about. And people would just jump up and start saying, well, I think it's like this. And then this is connected to this. And these people are here. And these are the stakeholders. And you'd hear someone else go, no, no, no. This is the way I see it. And they draw right over the other drawing. Because whiteboards are very low, low preciousness. You know, you don't feel precious about drawing on someone else's whiteboard or you know, erasing a little bit with your thumb and doing something versus even drawing on a piece of paper. It actually makes it so that people feel comfortable being able to explore ideas.
Oh, I love it. I especially love the required reading. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Well, and every year we would have required reading. Once a year in June, the owners would pick a book, and it was always The History of Epic Change. It was never a business book. You know, and so when we were exploring information visualization, we picked The Ghost Map, which is a book about by Stephen Johnson, a book about the cholera epidemic in the 1600s and 1700s in England, and about the first Dr. Snow and some other people who were the first people who did it, like a ghost map, a visualization of where the cholera deaths were, like little crosses on the map. And they are actually able to discover sort of, it was an early data visualization. And so every year we would have a book. And so there's a whole canon of books that also gave a sort of class of 2008, class of 2009, like everybody from the intern to the founders, to the receptionist at the front desk, to the accountant, everybody had to read the same book. And we would close the offices for an offsite retreat at the end of the summer. And we would explore why this book matters. And why, you know, what was the rationale? Why did we pick it? And, you know, so Team of Rivals, which was about Lincoln's presidency, was one of our books during the early primaries when Obama had said he would bring it to a desert island when he was a young senator, because we were curious about that. But it teaches a lot about leadership, actually.
That's great. I love that. And we already have people asking if you can provide a list of books. So
I'd be happy to do that. Yeah. Well, and I think the secret signal as a leader is you're sending that mastery matters, that actually growing your brain is something we care about. And so those are required readings of everybody. And we would buy the books for everybody. We'd sometimes have the author come in for the retreat. So it was a little bit of a surprise. They got a chance to see inside of Stephen Johnson's brain when he was doing Ghost Map. And he could say, no, actually, I learned this was happening. And he would jump up at the whiteboard as well. You know. And so it was a really fascinating approach to kind of get people to have a shared experience, but also to send a signal from a cultural standpoint, we care about mastery.
Mm. Yeah, and lifelong curiosity and lifelong
learning.
So can you share some examples of the work that you did at Maya, particularly the stuff that you did with DARPA?
Yeah, so at DARPA, we worked with them for probably 15 years or more. And so we all had to have a secure clearance and everything, all the senior leaders and the people who were working on the project. And sometimes we'd be out at DARPA and sometimes we'd be, you know, at some of their gatherings for their principal investigators. And the effort we did was around direct manipulation information visualization. So it was for commanders to be able to actually directly manipulate information as it was coming from all sorts of different things to actually have a view into this really messy space that could, you know, you might think of as the fog of war. And so if you were a logistics person, you might be looking at something on a timetable. But if someone else was planning some other aspect of this, maybe they were intel or they were doing intelligence work or they were doing other things, they might be looking at a map So you're looking at it on a timetable, they're looking at it on a map, but if you shake it on the timetable, it would shake on the map because there was only one piece of information. We enforced what's called Pauli's exclusion principle. Basically, there's, you know, two atoms can't exist in the same place at the same time. And we enforce that for information, unique identity in the entire universe so that you knew you were talking about the same thing. And you could also kind of collaborate. And then we implemented something called polymorphic collaboration, which means that if I took this timetable, I could like morph it into a map and actually see how the data would look, or I could morph it into other things. But you could look at it your way, I could look at it my way, and we could collaborate over it. And this became something called the Command Post of the Future, big initiative. When the war with Iraq was happening, General Corelli came to us, and he actually saw this war game that we ran. We would run a war game where we'd simulate a year and a week, 24 hours a day, so that you could actually figure out what was happening when you were building these early prototypes. And, you know, the battles were like in Ohio Stan versus Pennsylvania Stan or something. I don't know. But it was a simulated space where you simulate the future. Yeah. But he saw it, and he basically was deploying with the 1st Cavalry in January. He saw this in October, and he said, well, that's so much better than our command post system. I want it. And we said, this is made of chewing gum. This is like held together with duct tape, because when you work on DARPA things, you know, they're like 10 years into the future. And he said, well, what would it take for us to deploy this to Iraq, to the green zone, and actually use it? Because it's so much better than what we're doing now, which is we see some insights, people kill the insights, they put it into this dead thing called a PowerPoint presentation. And then they, you know, then like 4 hours later, they present it at their update meeting. And the data has changed, like life has changed in that time. And so we actually had to play with how the commanders would actually learn to deal with the fact that this was living information. And it was accreting new knowledge all the time. And so that system, to my knowledge, has never been turned off after it deployed to Iraq. But there's an accretion of that information. And he found, let's say, $20-some million in the course of a few months, and was able to like actually encourage us to deploy this. So we actually hired a whole bunch of more people from Carnegie Mellon and other places. And we deployed our own designers and our own cognitive psychologists to Iraq, to the Green Zone, to help actually stand it up. And the first, you know, first month or two were pretty bumpy, because it was like, you know, it was a prototype. It was like saying, I built this cute little foam core table to show you what the conference room was like, you know, and people were like, cool, let's have our board meeting at that table. And we're like, no, it's made of foam core. So that was an exciting time. That system, we ended up spinning out a company to help commercialize that called Maya Viz. And that actually got acquired by General Dynamics Mission Systems. So now it's a part of Mission Systems.
Oh my gosh. That sounds super.
It was a wild ride.
Yeah, especially for the ones who had to go into the green zone to do that.
It was wild. But, you know, they were able to do human-centered design right there. They could actually see how the commanders were using it. They could see how people were getting confused and worried about it. And the idea was you could learn in an afternoon how to use the tools. And so it was really about implementing what we called interaction physics. You know, if you ever did something, you know, if I grab this glass and I drop it, it always falls. Well, that's a contract with the universe. You know, all those deep details like gravity were sealed in at the Big Bang. And that means that you can trust it, and you can use your monkey brain to say, oh, cool, if I can do that, I can set it down on this and it works, and I can do other things. And so we implemented interaction physics in the tools as well, so that as people were learning them, they learned a few things that always worked. They were like a guaranteed contract, and they would build new things on top of it. So if you went back 6 months later, and our people who were deployed there were watching, and they would go back and forth, the tools would look totally different 6 months later, because they had actually made them their own. And they had done what we call sort of end user scripting, where people at the end could actually be tapped into to be the innovators themselves, the actual end users.
Oh, that's so cool. So you spent a lot of time focused on integrating ideas with technology to create an actual product that people can use, that being an example. So what were the techniques that you found to be most helpful, and what wasn't as important as you thought it would be on the flip side?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things was, you know, prototype for action versus archiving, you know, like rapidly create a prototype. And when I say prototype, it might be a prototype of a whole experience, it, you know, not just a particular piece of software or a particular piece of hardware or a particular product piece, okay, but prototype the out-of-box experience if it's a consumer product. Prototype what the end unit would look like when somebody walks into the store. And it could all just be foam core, or it could be whatever, or prototype in code, you know? And so we would make interfaces out of paper, like little flashcards, and we'd think through a set of tasks. And then when people would click on the flashcard, they would just push on the flashcard. We would say, think out loud. Imagine that your brain is on speakerphone. And when they clicked on it, we would be the computer. We'd swap the cards and we'd actually play the whole thing out before we committed to writing code or anything else. That's called Wizard of Oz prototyping. We're the wizard behind the curtain. And we're just pulling the levers and making the big head talk, you know, and we're just an old man behind the curtain. But, you know, if Toto was around, he'd find us. But the idea was that by doing that and doing what we call think aloud ethnographic research or user research, we could actually hear what people would expect. Oh, I got lost. I'm not sure what I should do. Should I click on this? And they'd be clicking on a piece of paper and we wouldn't do anything. We'd just sitting there. And they're like, I guess that doesn't work. And then they'd like click on something else. And then we'd swap out the paper, you know? And so we could hear them thinking. And when you can do that, you can discover all these beautiful little unmet needs and unvoiced needs before you commit to like making that product, you know, a permanent thing. The other one was this wargaming idea. We would simulate a year and a week and a day. We would say, okay, it's Tuesday. That means it must be July, you know, and we would try different things for Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, we would say, okay, now it's October. And something else has happened. And we would have people work overnight to come up with like the new scenario. And then we'd come out with it. And it was kind of a game, but it was a way for us to discover what people really cared about. And we could also see what would happen over time so you could actually understand how you could actually continue to add features or functionality that was really highly valued. I think that was really important. I definitely would say that just in general, this notion of not just talking to people at the beginning, you know, doing good, you know, I sent out a survey to people. I want stuff. Most of that's almost useless. You know, you end up talking to like, you send a survey to 1,000 people, you get a few insights. But if you actually do user research and ethnographic research and human-centered design research and participatory research, where you actually say like, we'll play a game where we assign Monopoly money to each of the features. And you have to like figure out how you can buy all the features you want, but we don't give you quite enough money. So now you've actually got to negotiate with other people around the table. And that's called buy a feature. That's a human-centered design method. If you do that with only 10 people, you get like 100 insights and you get all these insights for this. So I think that's hugely important. We ended up spinning out another company from Maya called Luma Institute. You can look that up today. We've taught about 80,000 people around the world and certified them how to do these human-centered design methods. And we looked at maybe 1,000 to 1,500 methods that have been accumulated over 100 years. And we boiled them down into 36 methods that people in every profession use all the time. So they're well-used, that can be learned enough to be dangerous so that you can do a little bit yourself in a 2-day workshop and you can try it out the next week. And that were broadly applied, whether it was designing software, whether it was designing buildings, whether it was designing systems, whether it was designing vehicles. So we tried to stay away from the esoteric stuff that only like the head of IDEO could do or something like that and say, let's actually give you tools that you can use. And so Luma Institute is one of the other things that we said. We noticed a lot of people would leave our offices and say, how come we don't do this when we go back to our office? And it was because they just didn't know those methods. And so we started teaching them those methods.
And you mentioned surveys not being as important as anyone thinks they are. Is there anything else that you're just like, that's so difficult?
Well, I think the reason I say that is because people tell you about their best day. They tell you about their, you know, their what they imagine the day is. But if you actually go and do, maybe we'd say it's something called contextual inquiry, where you're actually in context, you're walking the floor of the factory, and you notice a post-it note over here, or you notice something else there, and you go, why did you put that post-it note there? Or you just observe what they're doing, and right in context, you go, why did you do that? You actually end up discovering, oh yeah, well, it turns out that when the maintenance guys come by, they actually can hear when a bearing is going bad. And so we've got this little thing that we set up so that we could like get their insights whenever they come back from a walk, because they would know something that we couldn't detect. And this was, of course, before the Internet of Things, and you would discover this stuff. So contextual inquiry is really powerful. The surveys often are not well designed either. And even interview questions are not well designed. You ask yes, no questions and you don't get really any insights. But if you learn how to do good interviews, you can use open-ended questions, you can discover new things. Even just shadowing people works really well. Just shadow a day in their life. So surveys, the other thing I notice is that a lot of people will talk to end users or talk to stakeholders early, and then they'll go do a whole bunch of stuff. And then they're wondering why their support costs are so high, or why it's not working the way they thought. And it's because they didn't keep up this constant, almost what we would call a double helix, where you're like pulling out new research and you're pulling in new, you know, research from the R&D labs, and you're pulling in new research from the human-centered design side of things, and you're pulling each other. And they're kind of like, we call them a double helix because they pull on each other. They'd evolve what your business model was. They'd evolve what you should go out and actually do in the labs. And that's how we would learn how to do better R&D. And I ended up applying this later. I shifted to being a fellow in the office of the CTO at Autodesk. And so we would do this as well for our strategic foresight team. We would help the C-suite really understand where the world was going by running way in the future and finding this kind of stuff, doing this double helix approach, and then back chaining to today and saying, if you want that future, you might have to turn by 5 degrees today, and this is what you should invest in now. And so it's very different than traditional R&D. Often is evolutionary. It's kind of moving forward. What we would say is like run far ahead and then backward chain. And that I think is an important trick as well.
So that actually tees up my next question really nicely. So, you know, when you were at Autodesk, you were doing the strategic foresight and also generative design. So what tools did you really enjoy trying out? And, you know, were there any that didn't live up to expectations? You know, what was the lay of the land there?
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of Autodesk. I'm still a fellow emeritus at Autodesk, but I've pulled back from daily kind of working on things right now, just working with one research team in the UK at the moment. But, you know, I'm a big fan of, they have over 200 tools, and they were exploring this idea of generative design. And the notion was that instead of you using a CAD tool, computer-aided design tool, which is really computer-aided drafting, you'd like figure out your ideas and then you go into the tool and use these robot arms to like draft out what it was. How might you focus on the goals, the constraints, and the obstacles, and really get good at defining the goals, the constraints, and the obstacles, and then spawn thousands of machine learning agents, basically junior architects who would wander around trying to implement and reach those goals and those constraints. And that was called generative design. So you would focus on the almost the dimensions of the problem, the goals, constraints, and obstacles. So if I'm building, let's say I want to build a skateboard. I know that there's this truck on the bottom of the skateboard that you bolt a wheel on both sides. Well, I know that you've got to have like an obstacle for where the wheels go, because you better not grow your truck into that wheel. And you've also got to have a little place where the axle can be screwed on. So you've got to, you just draw a little obstacle. You also know there's a lot of forces going in this direction because you're standing on the skateboard. So you drag an arrow around and you point it down and you see how many newtons there are. So it's got to support this many newtons. Or you know that it's got to tilt a little bit. So you put some obstacles on the side so that it can tilt. And then it goes off and generates thousands of permutations of what that skateboard could look like. You could say one of the constraints is I want to do it with additive manufacturing. Well, then it would generate things that look really good and look possible from an additive manufacturing standpoint. Maybe it can be additively made out of aluminum alloy or something. Or you could say one of the goals is it needs to be milled out of a chunk of aluminum or something. So CNC, so it's a more subtractive method. Well, that would take on that goal and it would try to figure out how to reach that goal. Or it might be, I want to make it additively, but out of titanium. Well, titanium works very differently than aluminum. And so the end up shape would look totally different. And so we ended up using tools that we basically modified a software called Maya, unrelated to the design studio that I was running. And Maya was a tool that was built by a group called Alias Wavefront that later became part of Autodesk. And it was used by James Cameron, and it was used by a bunch of game developers to actually build all the crazy special effects in Hollywood. But we ended up saying this tool it's so programmable, it has easy scripting, this end user scripting, that we could actually build this tool called Dreamcatcher. And we said, let's actually build a tool inside of an existing Autodesk tool to explore this notion of generative design. And then we'll write the code and the algorithms in the background to like do the little agent-based modeling. And that was our first tool. Now it's actually been rolled into real Autodesk tools. So if you were to use something called Fusion, which is a computer-aided design tool, it's got generative design built into it. As you do it, you can even say what the cost constraints are, and it uses a calculator for bill of materials, and it comes up with these permutations. One of the downsides of generative design, and this, I think this is an emerging space that's pretty significant. We've used it for architecture. We've used it for a lot of other things now. But one of the downsides for generative design is you can be overwhelmed with options. You know, you can see thousands of options because all these agents come back with lots of options. So then you have to visualize and be able to give people like pairwise constraints. Like, I want to see a building that I've designed, but with good buzz, like people are able to get together and kind of chat around the coffee cooler, but also with great sight lines to the outside, because I know that like sunlight really matters for people's productivity. So I sort by, you know, buzz by sight lines, and it suddenly filters all those things down by like high level ones. And so it gives you a tool to kind of explore and realize those goals were wrong. Maybe I needed a different goal, and you'd readjust the goal. So when we first showed it to architects, or we showed it to engineers, or we showed it to designers, they were like, oh, really? My job is over? I like, you're going to replace me with a machine? It's just going to be curation? Oh, I'm not a curator. I don't feel like a curator. I'm an engineer, damn it. Or I'm a designer. I'm an architect. And what it turned out was, after about them using it for a month, they basically said, I can't go back. Like, I'm exploring. It's like having 1,000 interns, and I can spawn them off and figure out, but it's forcing me to rethink about what my goals are and what my constraints are and have that conversation with my end client or with my end user, and be able to explore it. So I think it's a fascinating space. It's certainly challenging because multi-component generative design is still really computationally intensive. I mean, you can send this off to the cloud of things, but it's really, if you've got like a BMW, it's got 40,000 parts just in the front end of that car. You know, there's a lot going on in the front end, and having like a complete assembly, you know, this one generates, then this one generates, well, it changes what this one should do, and then that changes what this one should do. So actually component-based generative design is fairly straightforward now. Assembly-based generative design has become pretty intensive, and we're starting to now see using proxy models and using some other methods to make that work. But it's an active area of research.
Oh, that's so cool. I love the idea of an army of interns. It's my dream. So, you know,
sometimes those interns grow up to be your leader or to be your boss. I mean, I think you actually want the act of you even teaching this kind of dumb thing. And we have to remember that machine learning has no mental model. It has no common sense. There's no system in the world today, no matter what Google or somebody else claims or their DeepMind claims. Everybody knows there's no system today that has a mental model, or what we would call wisdom, that we have naturally, that a four-year-old starts accreting early on and can do like one-shot modeling that, you know, unfortunately with machine learning, you've got to have like a massive training data set. So humans are still amazing. And I think what happens though, is the act of you teaching this kind of dumb thing, like what you're really looking for, forces you to really think about what you really care about and forces you to have a higher level conversation with your team to really collaborate on it. And you can kind of push and prod, and they can push and prod, and you can kind of learn what you really care about. And so anytime you can teach, it actually helps you figure out what you really know and your sort of tacit knowledge and be able to encode that.
Yeah, definitely. So how do you think this applies to R&D and how to select the right tools for innovation?
There are all sorts of ways. I think as we look at this space, you know, what would generative design for R&D look like? Not for just one particular thing, like a particular product, but more broadly, you know, how might I focus on goals and constraints and spawn a bunch of different kinds of systems that could go explore those constraints? So one of the things I'm working with at BCG is something called deep tech. And deep tech, or sometimes called hard tech, is where you actually have not only software, but you've got atoms. You know, you've got both atoms and bits coming together. And so things like quantum computation and quantum telecommunication are deep tech. They're things that it used to be that only like very large nation states could really even maybe make progress on. And we just still don't even know if we'll be able to do. I think there's already quantum telecommunication happening both in China and in the US, but we don't know about quantum computing yet. It's still too noisy. But it's a space that's really interesting. And I think if you really understand the nature of technology, new technologies arise. And in R&D, you know, you're trying to push the limits of a new technology. You're trying to take something out of research, pure basic research. You know, Niels Bohr thinks about this new thing called quantum mechanics. Einstein thinks he's crazy, and that's, you know, God doesn't play dice with the universe. But then we start seeing actual experimental proof that it's true. So we're trying to move from this basic research and get it down to something we can actually apply and apply the research. So I think there's a space here to move in that direction, particularly around deep technologies. But one thing you can know about technology is that any new technology solves some problem, but it actually creates 10 more problems of its own. So that's a good ratio to understand. Like, you build this beautiful thing, it's called a jet engine, and we used to have propeller engines. But because you built this jet engine, it's amazing, but you know what? It doesn't cool things very well. And it's really got a problem with some other things like the flow of fluids. So even though it solves one problem, I want to go faster, more efficiently, it creates 10 more problems. And that actually pulls out traditional technologies in new ways. And that's actually one of the things we can do in R&D, is kind of have systems that help us explore how to nurture those really fragile new technologies by tapping into the wealth of knowledge, the patents and all the things in the past, to explore what we could actually use from traditional technology to kind of shore up those precious, delicate new technologies. So in the deep tech space, I think we need this. So this is around synthetic biology, for example. We're actually learning how to apply sort of computer code discipline to synthetic biology. And that's why we're actually now able to do new invention. Jennifer Doudna, when she won the Nobel Prize for CRISPR with Carpentieri, the two of them were doing something where they actually took one thing that was evolved by yeast, another thing that was evolved somewhere else thousands of years ago by bacteria, and glued it together and actually pulled out some of the extra atoms and molecules and created something that no life on Earth had ever created, which was CRISPR. So that was true invention, but it was kind of applying some classic methods of both computational engineering as well as sort of basic chemistry and things like that. So I think I'm rambling a little bit here, but I think it's a very exciting space, but we have to like look at how we might apply these tools to help us explore this space in interesting ways.
So you talked about machine learning, and you know, we can see it improves, and we see it integrated more into R&D as it evolves. So any thoughts on adopting machine learning into R&D?
Well, you know, I think there's some amazing work. I'm trying to remember his name. He's at Tufts University, and he ended up using a high-performance computing cluster, basically a supercomputer cluster, to explore how planaria evolve. Planaria are really simple worms. They're flatworms. But if you cut the flat, and they're really well studied. So there are actually research papers that go back to like the early 1900s, the late 1800s. So he said, why don't I consume all those research papers? I'll consume how their methods were for the scientific inquiry. I'll consume the data. Like, when you cut a planaria this way, it grows two heads. When you cut a planaria another way, it grows two tails. There's a weird thing about how could you make a prediction about where you cut something and how it would geometrically grow. And even though it's been the most studied little worm in the world, nobody actually had ever come up with a theory that worked for this. So he consumed all this. He actually turned it all into machine readable code over 100 years. And he gave it to the machine learning cluster. And he basically said, let's actually give it, you know, not all the information so that we could test it against theories and stuff, but let's give it enough as training data. Let's see what it does. And in the first 1,000 iterations, it just didn't have anything. In the first 10,000 iterations, it started to actually make assertions about like methodology. In the next like 100,000 iterations, it actually found problems in the methodology from existing research papers that we didn't even know about, that were actually well accepted in the scientific literature. And over time, it started to do this stuff. And so he ended up winning a genius grant from the Paul Allen Institute to set up his own lab at Tufts. I think it's Michael Nielsen or Michael, I'll have to find it. But amazing work. And so it really changes my perspective on what R&D can do, because suddenly we can actually start to look at even the scientific method itself. And we can start to look at kind of exploring new approaches to the scientific method, because repeatability in science is a real problem. There's a serious replication problem in science. And it's just not fun to repeat somebody else's experiments. It's a lot more fun to create your own new one and get published in a journal. And we don't have like journals of failure, unfortunately, because that would tell us a lot about what works and what doesn't. So I actually think there's a massive space here that is yet to be explored. And I think Michael's showing some examples. His now current work, I just talked to him a little while ago, is now focused on seeing if he can teach the cells around cancer cells how to teach the cancer to go back to being normal cells again. So actually using the immune system, but using it as a sort of educational tool to like remind the cell how to go back and actually breed normally again. And he's starting to get some pretty tantalizing results. So it's a really big new space, but we also have to just enter it with a bit of a jaded eye, because the claims of people that are working in AI are often misplaced or salesmanship. I mean, you know, IBM famously sold off their Watson division recently because it turns out that Watson was great at playing Jeopardy, but not so great at doing radiology. And so, you know, or replacing radiologist jobs. But I do think we'll see more stuff come out of this. It's just that really understanding where they are collaborators, it goes back to interdisciplinary collaboration. It's just that the machine collaborators are going to collaborate with human collaborators. And the machines might even be foremen or managers. At Autodesk, we built a giant hive, like 30 feet tall, but it was actually robot arms and watches and random people who would walk up during our big university event, and they would put on a watch and it would tell them, go grab this piece of bamboo, go hand it and lock it in, do the thing you're good at with the robot arm. The robot arm will weave like a tensegrity structure around it. And then slowly this group of random people that didn't know how to build a structure over the course of 2 days built a 40-foot structure where the foreman was actually a machine learning tool that was actually coordinating the human workers and the robot workers. So I do think we're going to see all that sort of stuff happen. That was at Autodesk.
Can you talk a bit more about these human machine teams and how you think you'll interact? You already touched on it with, you know, the architects and the army of interns, and, you know, how do you think this is all going to go?
Well, I do think this is kind of interesting. One of the projects we recently did with H&M. So they're just, this is BCG now. And one of the projects we did with H&M, they're a fashion retailer. They have, you know, retail stores around the world. One of their biggest problems is inventory. So you can imagine you ordered a whole bunch of stuff, and then it doesn't sell during Christmas or it doesn't sell during a big selling event. And you have this massive inventory. It's very expensive. It's sitting in your warehouses. And so we looked at who, you know, the local managers at all the stores who were choosing what they should order for inventory. And we built in 4 weeks, we built a little machine learning tool that could actually do about 5% or 10% better than the actual managers who were doing the ordering, you know, and the kind of planning out. And that was pretty good. I mean, within 4 weeks, we were able to get like a 5 or 10% rise from this machine learning algorithm. But what was curious is when it would go wrong, it would go horribly wrong. Like it would really order the wrong stuff. And that was because it has no mental model. It has no common sense. So common sense reasoning is still a serious problem for machine learning. So we went back and we also heard from the people who were doing all that ordering. They're like, are you going to put me out of a job? You know, in 4 weeks, you just suddenly found something that was better than anybody in the world at H&M that was doing this order. We said, actually, no, it turns out when it goes bad, it goes really bad. So then we spent another 6 weeks kind of working on tools to collaborate with the machine learning so that the best, you know, managers at these locales who had all this data, really, because they saw people walking in the door. They saw the fashion trends on the street, but it wasn't being encoded in any way. It was just this wisdom that they were getting because they were there on the street. They were immersed in the context. So we gave them tools for that. And suddenly 25% increase in productivity, 25% within 6 weeks later. So when you actually look at how you collaborate and when you look for what humans are great at, and when you look for, you know, for what machines are great at creativity with generative adversarial networks. They come up with crazy novel things. It just sometimes they're just off the wall. And humans are great at creativity. So we shouldn't say let's not have a machine learning system be there because it's going to take away our job. It's not going to take away our job from a creativity standpoint, but it might push us up another level where we've actually got to think a little differently about this. So I do think that's a great example of how different things could be if we actually started thinking about them as collaborators and as part of an interdisciplinary team that you know have strengths and have weaknesses.
I love that. So I've got a couple more questions, but I want to make sure we get the audience questions coming in. We've already got one coming in, so I want to make sure we cover that because I realize the hour is quickly going away. So this one's from Rick Arthur at GE. I think you know Rick.
Yeah. So, hey, Rick.
So he asked, how should human fan influencers assert human-centric framing to decision makers as technology is increasingly capable of automating a wider variety of tasks, often with significant productivity and/or variable cost reduction?
Yeah. Well, I think this relates to that H&M example in some ways. You know, putting people first forces us to really understand how humans have wisdom and common sense and how to tap into that wisdom and common sense. And so humans are the ones who are actually going to be pulling the levers or making decisions or doing certain things. And there are some things that should just be automated. And I would actually agree with those decision makers that like, yeah, automate that stuff. That's fine. It's not like people went into their office every day wanting to do that, all that work. But if you actually look at what humans are good at, and you look at that unmet need, what we've noticed is by being really sensitive to the unmet need and by being sensitive to the creativity and the common sense and the passion, humans bring passion to the table. And so far, machines don't have passion. You know, give it a few years maybe. But humans can't help themselves. You know, if you give them some curious challenge, they love productive struggle. Like they actually grow by it. We are super motivated by productive struggle, by that idea that we're actually moving forward, but we're learning along the way and mastering something new. And humans can't help themselves. If you were to go to like a flea market and look at just at like an antique market, there's one here in San Francisco, just up in Oakland, once, or on Alameda Island, every month they close one end of the island. It's all antiques. They're like 40 years old. You wander through there and all you can think is, oh my gosh, humans can't help themselves. There's so much junk here, but so much crazy invention, you know, from these amazing antiques. So I think if I were talking to decision makers, I would say we're leaving money on the table if we don't actually tap into what humans are great at. But the proportion might be different. We might have like one human to you know, 10 of these algorithms or something like that versus 10 humans to one system. So I think it's really understanding the unmet needs, understanding the wisdom and the common sense and the creativity that can go into this and the passion, and then looking for places that they can do things that machines just aren't going to do anytime soon. And actually trying to level up in that space and saying you're leaving money on the table if you're not tapping into this because of both employee excitement. I mean, being able to feel productive struggle is one of the best rewarding things you can do after you pay people enough to sort of take it off the table. Mastery is a huge motivator. I don't know. And nobody on this call is on this call because they were told to be on the call, I doubt. I think they want to learn something and they're trying to grapple with how this works. So, I mean, I think that's a great question. I don't know if I know all the answers to that, but I find that when I really show people this sort of idea that if you do machine learning, yes, you will get like a 6% improvement or a 10% improvement, maybe a 20% improvement. But if you actually tap it in with how the humans work, you could have double digit improvements. You could go over the top of that. I'll give you one other story for this. Starbucks. We have a little group inside of BCG called Digital Ventures. And so we put some money in, Starbucks put some money in, and we basically said, let's build a system that can actually do much more customization. So, you know, when you are in the store, could I increase your shopping bag? You know, could I get you to put more things in the shopping bag? And traditionally what they would do is they would reach out to an ad agency, they would do a campaign, they would build a spreadsheet. And a few months later, they'd like look at the spreadsheet, see if they had a little lift in their shopping bag thing. And they probably had like 9 personas, you know, archetypal users. After the process of doing this, we ended up with a system that had 400 algorithmic personas. And so it would dynamically figure out the economic value that you would attribute to it. So instead of just giving you a coupon that says, hey, you know, you're in the store right now, you know, get a free mocha latte. We actually knew you were lactose intolerant. We knew that you were just, you know, we could tell from some other the data that you were in the drive-through and that this it was raining outside. So we consumed a huge amount of information, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of data points. And then we actually built these algorithmic personas that would come up with economic value for the system. It was kind of like a game. But then what we found was instead of having all the agencies, we ended up Starbucks kind of let go a number of the agencies. But the marketers actually now had kind of a dashboard and they could really play with things. They could explore that space. So they became much more powerful. And they also found that the people who could write the code and think through this stuff would help them brainstorm on this. And so they were collaborating very differently. This ended up leading to $100 million worth of new revenue in the first year it was deployed. Non-trivial. So if I go to thought leaders or decision makers, I'm like, okay, that's money they were leaving on the table. And by the way, they did this with a team internally at Starbucks and with our team that we basically like hired. We created like a founder and a whole approach that was more entrepreneurial, and we had them go head to head. So this was a little bit of that wargaming stuff as well. You know, let's see who can do this stuff. And the team internally would never have thought they could have 400 algorithmic personas that were dynamically shaping things. They had never connected the cash registers up to their campaign systems or even what the local managers were doing. So now the managers that were local were actually part of the sensor network, and they were part of discovering the new things because we were tapping into what humans are good at.
I love that. So I want to make sure if anyone wants to jump in and do a face-to-face question, please feel free. Or you can type your questions into the chat here. But while we're waiting for that, so we talked about, you know, areas to think about for the future. We've done machine learning. So you touched on synthetic biology. So what about synthetic biology and sustainability? That's huge for our members.
It's huge.
So how do you think that's going to go together?
I just hosted a fireside chat with one of the leaders at Procter & Gamble on on emerging new products. And she's a big believer in synthetic biology. And she said, look, Procter & Gamble, P&G, we have made major commitments to sustainability by 2030. And she said, I do not believe we will get to those commitments if we don't engage synthetic biology. Because nature has been a manufacturer for like 3 billion years. Algae is solar powered manufacturing. You know, look outside, look at the trees, look at all the things. If we could tap into that, and if we could really get into this design, build, test, learn cycle and close that cycle so that we're using machine learning for that, what that's good about, but we're also using, you know, the idea of how synthetic biology can try out things in new ways. We're starting to see things. I just was at the largest synthetic bio conference. It's called Built with Biology. And that's where we had this fireside chat. And there were people putting scrubbers on the smokestacks of factories that were actually then creating fabric from the carbon coming off of those smokestacks. There were people that were looking at basically creating synthetic concrete that would absorb carbon as it was going. There were people that were, so these are not just trivial little things for human, you know, for human consumption. But if you look at, I mean, Procter & Gamble, they make a lot of stuff that technically is pretty toxic garbage at the end of it, you know, Pampers, something like that. And Tide soap. Well, it turns out a lot of the organic chemicals that are not petroleum-based aren't very good at cleaning. They aren't good as a surfactant. They aren't good as something else. So there's actual work to be done to design new molecules, to design new things. But if we don't embrace it, if we don't embrace and sort of co-design with nature, I think we're really in trouble from an environmental standpoint. We've got to start applying this. And I would recommend two readings on this. One of them would be Codebreakers by Walter Isaacson, which if I were still running Maya, that would be my book this year that I would pick. But it's about Jennifer Doudna and the quest for CRISPR, but it actually highlights where humans are now starting to apply creativity to what bacteria and viruses and others have already done. It's worth noting, we've only actually synthesized a handful of viruses. We have not been able to actually get to the point of synthesizing entirely new yeast or algae, which are really the factories of doing things, we're certainly far away from being able to generate an entire genome or generate an entire strand of DNA. We're just early in this. We don't have a lot of foundries for this yet. The other resource I'd point to is BCG. We published a paper around deep tech, particularly around nature co-design. And it's really about how we can embrace nature co-design. And so if you were to look up BCG deep tech nature co-design, you'd be able to find it. But we can put together a reading list as well and get some stuff.
I think so. I think we'll need a syllabus for these interviews from now on.
There has to be somebody else that has a question.
We do. So what metric should we use to measure progress related to human-centric framing?
I metrics are really interesting, and I think you can come up with new kinds of metrics for human-centered stuff. So like time to insight or time to action on insight, if it's around an information-based system, would be really powerful. Or time to people using new tools in expressive new ways. So a lot of times a new tool gets launched as it's a new feature or a new product, and you use it in very classic ways. the printing press was used to make a lot of illuminated manuscripts, or to take over illuminated manuscripts and print out a lot of Bibles and things like that. But over time, people started getting expressive. They started doing billboards and comic books and things like that. So I think the time to expressive use of that technology would be a metric that I might look at, where people are doing things differently with that technology, or they're expressing themselves. I also think this notion of trying to enable scripters, basically end users that are not the end user, but maybe one level up. So like, imagine I want people to buy this new thing called a PC, a personal computer. The killer app for personal computers in my mind was probably VisiCalc or Excel, because it was actually a generative framework. Al in accounting could take this spreadsheet and he could customize it for like expenses. He could do the end user scripting and put his business knowledge into the tool. And then he could send it out to all the salespeople and he could do that. And so there's that layer between the end user or the end stakeholder. And then there's the layer of the sort of person who could kind of script, who can kind of like customize. And I think if we tap into those end user scripters, that's the power of this. You know, it's going beyond just APIs or application programming interfaces and software development kits, but really saying, how can we help people who are effectively at the end script? Because then we can tap into that and learn new things. We can see their innovation. And if we're a platform, we can actually pull those innovations back in and start to see new kinds of metrics that we can measure for this.
That's awesome. So, you know, we talked a bit about hard tech and quantum computing. Yeah. So what do you think we need to be on the lookout for with that?
Well, I do think quantum computing, if any of the research teams are able to get past the noise limit, right now it's too noisy. And so we need to have a lot more qubits to be able to like actually mitigate that noise. And there is some wonderful work going on in this space. For example, Microsoft is exploring Mariana particles, which were invented by an Italian researcher in the 1930s or 40s, that sort of entrain the qubits kind of like a train going through a mountainside, so that they kind of can look at the one going in and the one coming out and actually discover something that reduces the noise. So there's a lot going on there. The reason I think quantum is so interesting and important is most of nature is quantum. So like imagine the Haber-Bosch process. This is this process we use to actually fix nitrogen and make all the fertilizer that we have in the world. Came out of World War II. The Haber-Bosch process, if you look at the actual atom involved in doing this fixing nitrogen, the molecule involved, it probably has like 25 or 30 atoms in it. But it would take all of classical computing until the heat death of the universe to figure out how those atoms interact. But it would take a quantum computer like an afternoon to be able to do this, because it's fundamentally quantum by nature. It's not, you know, we don't convert it to digital and then convert it back again. So I think there's a huge potential there for quantum computing, quantum telecommunication, quantum material science, which I think is an exciting space. I'm seeing some interesting stuff coming out of Israel there. But it's going to be as fundamental as the invention of the transistor once we get there. And that's why I think it'll be an entirely new epoch in technology and in exploration and invention. So I think that's why it's important to pay attention to it. Right now, people are dabbling with it. Rigetti Computing over in Berkeley is doing both hybrid digital physical system or digital quantum systems. And now their system with quantum Python is part of Amazon's offering in the cloud. So you can actually start dabbling with it. And you don't have quantum supremacy yet. But once we do, we're going to be able to solve logistics problems like the traveling salesman problem. We'll be able to solve molecular problems and actually probably unlock a lot more from a sustainability standpoint. And we'll be able to do a lot of other things. So there's excitement there. The reason also I think is interesting to watch is that suddenly quantum physicists can get a job. So none of our code in all computing systems, very little of our code has been written by quantum physicists or quantum mechanics. So suddenly thousands of quantum mechanics are actually writing code. And we're starting to see, like using Azure Cloud, we're starting to see them beat benchmarks for that were before believed that only could be solved with quantum, but they're actually quantum inspired algorithms running on normal systems. So that's like a second order effect that's coming out of this excitement and this investment in quantum computing, is that we're actually starting to see new forms of code and new forms of writing code and sort of quantum inspired algorithms that might help us get there before quantum computing is past its noise threshold.
I love that. They're all getting jobs. Good for them. So we're at time already, and I'm so sorry if anyone had any additional questions, but this has been fascinating. Mickey, thank you so much for taking the time to answer all of my questions and explained it all so well, because so much of it is just way outside of my comfort.
Exciting. And I think just learning about this, you can learn this. Everyone here can learn it and apply it and think through it. We have this growth mindset that we can actually do this stuff. And so I'm not particularly smart, but I've really learned it, like learning how to learn. And I think that's one of the things I would invest in my R&D, is helping people learn how to learn.
I love that. And giving them a reading list.
You bet.
All right.
I would say another book that pops into my mind that I think is essential reading for anybody who's in R&D is W. Brian Arthur's The Nature of Technology. It is a profound exploration of the evolutionary effects of technology and how it really works in a profound way. So I would recommend that, but you can ping me and I'll send you a few other things for reading.
Yes, please. And you also recommend a trip to the Henry Ford Museum in Detroit too.
Definitely. What an amazing space for invention.
All right. So again, Mickey, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, and good to see everybody.
And thanks everyone for joining us, and I'll send out the recording shortly. Thanks very much. Bye.